The city is proud to use data to inform its policies and practices in creating more inclusive, supportive, and safer spaces for LGBTQ plus people. So Eric, we'll take questions at the end of the presentations when we do the Q&A. We'll have a mic passing around. Thank you so much for joining us today, Eric.
This morning. It is an honor to be in this room of esteemed information specialists, data librarians, and technology professionals from around the world. But I look out of this room and I recognize that I'm also in a room full of storytellers, each of you equipped with your own special abilities and tools in the fight for social justice around the world. Now, when I was first approached to join you today, I was hesitant because I didn't know that I was the right person for this keynote. You see, I didn't begin my career as a social scientist, and I don't consider myself a data expert per se. So I wondered what my value would be to share with you all, because it is a supremely humbling experience to find yourself in front of a room of experts. Here to gain your insights and knowledge when at first thought you may not feel like you're the right message deliverer yourself. But with some more careful consideration, I realized that what I can share with you is how to recognize your unique power, harness it, and use it to make the world a better place. And through my experiences, how throughout my life and career, I've learned to do exactly that. So to illustrate what led me to this point, allow me to share some of my origin story with you. To begin, I will say that I've always been interested in social impact and supporting my communities, being an active volunteer, being an engaged citizen from the time I was very young. And when I was in high school, I participated in the local AIDS walk year after year with the student theater troupe, of which I was the vice president. Thank you very much. And as an undergraduate in college, I was active in FON, which is the largest student-led philanthropy in the world, working to end childhood cancer. And now throughout my graduate studies and up until today, where I now serve as a government official supporting the LGBTQ community in one of the largest cities in the United States. Now, as I said, I did not begin my career in social impact. I actually started out in the arts. I studied fine art for years in high school and on through higher education as well. And I went to Penn State University for my undergraduate studies. I'm actually from State College, Pennsylvania, which is where Penn State is. And in my high school, if you had plans to go to college, those plans were to go to Penn State. And at the time, I was interested in arts and theater, but I should clarify or maybe defend myself. I was not an actor. I worked behind the scenes as a designer, specifically as a costume designer. And I think I was so drawn to that because I loved being able to share people's stories. Costume design gave me the opportunity to tell stories through the way that people dress and what they communicate about themselves and their personal narrative through how they show up in the world. And it was compelling to me as a young person who loved people and loved being a storyteller. So I decided to study costume design in undergrad at Penn State. And it was through that work that I gained a skill set that was very valuable to a very niche area, or so I thought at the time. And then when I came to graduate from Penn State several years later, I didn't know what to do next. And what does one do when they don't know what to do next in life? They go to graduate school. So I found myself at Carnegie Mellon University, acclaimed research university in Pittsburgh, filled with some of the world's preeminent scholars in robotics, science, technology. And what did I study there? Also costume design. So then I received an even more specialized education and now a master's degree in a field that is, again, very niche. Now, of course, I'm proud of the experience that I gained there, but in my view, at the time, it wasn't exactly transferable skills that I was developing. So when I graduated from Carnegie Mellon University, I moved out west to Los Angeles to work in the entertainment industry. And that did not last very long for me. I was there for about a year and a half just doing the grind, and while I was fortunate to have steady work, it was very challenging. And I began to realize that it wasn't really fulfilling to me anymore. Now, to put this timeline into context, this was 2014, 2015, and at this time there was a real sentiment growing in the country of changing political winds. This was the advent of the 2016 presidential election in the United States, and during that period I had begun to feel like my work, dressing celebrities for red carpet events or up-and-coming musicians for their music videos, as much as I used to enjoy it, I knew I wanted to be able to bring to the world something that could be more useful to more people and make more of an impact in my community. So I left Los Angeles, I moved back to the East Coast, here to Philadelphia, where I had family and a few friends, and I started volunteering again because I wanted to get involved in my new community here. So I started doing a couple gigs at William Way, which is the LGBT community center here. And before I knew it, the election had happened, the result I imagine we all remember. And from there, I was really determined that I needed to take my volunteerism and my passion for social impact to the next level. So I began to research my options for furthering my education and social impact, and I came across this incredible opportunity at the University of Pennsylvania. Now, being in Philadelphia, I was aware of Penn's influence in the city, but for me to consider gaining the knowledge and expertise that came along with a graduate degree from an Ivy League institution like Penn turned out to be even more valuable than I could have even imagined in the moment. The program, a Master of Science degree in nonprofit leadership, promised that we would learn to create social impact through thoughtful, inventive, and meaningful work in nonprofits, charitable foundations, international NGOs, and more, and that it was ideal for existing nonprofit professionals, those looking to change their careers, or like me, were launching a career in a new sector. Now, of course, all of this sounded good on paper, but I had a few reservations. A, would I need to take a standardized exam to apply, because I didn't know how I was gonna do that. And honestly, if I had to, I might not go through with it. And B, would I have to write a thesis? Because the idea of writing a second thesis after already completing one in such a niche, specialized field was a very daunting task to me at the time. So in the pursuit of more knowledge and to quell my fears, I set up an informational interview with one of the academic advisors in the program, and they assured me that I did not have to do either of those things, so that pretty much sealed the deal for me. I put an application essay together, and I leaned heavily on what drew me to the program and my experience to this point in nonprofits. Now, whether I realized it at the time or not, I had been working in an arts and theater background, so I was working in nonprofits for years. So many theaters operate as nonprofits, and I felt either as an arts administrator or maybe as a budding social scientist working in a more traditional social impact nonprofit, that having skills in the leadership of nonprofits was a valuable opportunity for me to pursue. So I submitted my application, and to my surprise, I was pleased to be accepted to UPenn School of Social Policy and Practice. And I started the courses that summer and joined classmates from all over the world with varied interests and backgrounds and unique journeys that brought them to this program and what they had hoped to pursue post-graduation. And I was especially intrigued to see that there were plenty of fellow classmates who had backgrounds in the arts but now wanted to focus their skills on social impact. I think it was a sign of the times. Let me just take this opportunity to say that the theater to politics or theater to government pipeline is very real. It's what brought me to UPenn and the mayor's office and eventually to this stage today and this moment right now. So that is to say, you really never know where your career journey is going to take you. So here I was at Penn, surrounded by folks from all walks of life, varied interests from all over the world, gaining a real formative education in everything that doing successful social impact work entails. Everything from fiscal management of nonprofits to governance and responsibilities of board members, executive leadership, strategic planning, marketing and communication, development and fundraising, every aspect of what it takes to run an NGO and be an effective social impact leader, we covered. And I was thrilled with my experience in the classroom and to gain such valuable knowledge and insight from my professors. But one of the most valuable opportunities that came to me while I was a student in that program was through my field placement. So for those of you who are familiar with social work studies, most programs require you to work a certain number of hours in the field for you to contribute to earning your degree. And while my degree is not in social work, it had a similar structure. We're actually housed in the same school at Penn. So we were required to work a number of hours in the field, and we were provided a whole list of attractive options to choose from. And while there were many options on this predetermined list, I had my sights set on one unlisted opportunity in particular. I wanted to work with the City of Philadelphia government, and specifically in the Mayor's Office of LGBT Affairs. Now, the Office of LGBT Affairs was already on my radar because the then executive director of that office was an alumni of Penn School of Social Policy and Practice. And why I wanted to work with this organization, and with her in particular, was because she had used the power of design and storytelling to create social impact in her community. So let me just pause for a moment to acknowledge today's date. Today is June 1st, the first day of LGBT Pride Month here in the United States and many countries around the world. And as you may be aware, one of the most iconic and enduring symbols of LGBTQ pride the world around is the rainbow flag. Now, the original flag itself was created by an activist named Gilbert Baker back in the mid-70s, just a few years after the Stonewall Uprising, which is what is widely considered to be the birth of the contemporary LGBTQ civil rights movement in this country. And Baker's original flag had 8 stripes on it: pink, red, orange, yellow, green, turquoise, blue, and violet, and each represented a specific meaning and connection to gay life. Now, eventually, due to the ease of production, turquoise and pink were dropped, and the 6-striped rainbow flag that can be found everywhere from corporate pride campaigns to emojis on your phone was born. But in recent years, a new version of the flag has taken hold, and one that many in the community now associate with pride. And this new version of the flag extends beyond the traditional 6 stripes of the rainbow, including the addition of black and brown stripes. And what you may not know is that those black and brown stripes were actually added right here in Philadelphia at the Mayor's Office of LGBT Affairs, where I currently serve as the Deputy Director, and where I got my first professional opportunity as an emerging social impact leader at my field placement all those years ago at the University of Pennsylvania. This version of the flag, officially called the More Color, More Pride flag, debuted in 2017. So at this time, we are now living under the Trump administration in the United States. It was one of the more actively adversarial federal governments towards our community in recent memory. The Ryan White program, a federally operated HIV and AIDS support program, had its funds diverted to increasing migrant detentions at the southern border. And across the country, there's been a notable uptick in hate crimes and violence against minority communities. And one of the areas that Philadelphia saw a significant increase was in anti-black discrimination, particularly in certain businesses in the city's neighborhood. Now, you've been in Philadelphia for a couple of days. If this is your first time here, welcome. Hope you're enjoying your visit. Come back and stay sometime. But if you've been here before, then surely you know, or you've at least heard of our vibrant neighborhood. It's actually not far from here. It's just a few blocks over, right in Center City. And you can't miss the rainbow crosswalks at the intersection of 13th and Locust. Now, our neighborhood is a beautiful melting pot of LGBTQ cultures, rich with history, because Philadelphia actually played its own role in LGBT civil rights that in some ways predates New York and the Stonewall Uprisings of 1969. So I encourage you to check it out while you're here, and if you go, tell my friends at Knock Lounge I say hi. Now, back at the time, in 2017, there was a number of bars and nightclubs and businesses in the city's neighborhood that had adopted discriminatory practices against members of color in the LGBTQ community in the city. Many of the nightclubs had racially coded policies that were very clearly meant to keep certain people out. For example, no fitted baseball caps, no baggy jeans, no Timberland boots, all very clearly meant to keep folks of a certain demographic out of their establishment. So this was brought to the attention of the city's then executive director of LGBT affairs and the first black femme to lead that office, Amber Hikes, who, by the way, uses pronouns she and they interchangeably, as I will when I refer to her. So in their role, they worked closely with the Philadelphia Commission on Human Relations, which is the city's civil rights enforcement agency. And following a series of hearings, one of the first things that Amber did was to partner with a marketing agency to create a visual symbol that helped the community understand that their concerns were being prioritized. And that symbol came in the form of what became to be known as the More Color, More Pride flag. Now, for some additional context, Amber stepped into this role at a time of great tumultuousness, not only because of an increasingly hostile federal government at the time, but because her predecessor had been asked to resign from her role because she was not meeting the needs of the community appropriately at the time. So Amber, having a very different approach and being a social worker herself, graduate of Penn Social Policy and Practice, wanted to make sure that she was meeting the community's needs head on and being receptive and understanding their concerns. So at the time, Amber took the concerns that the community brought back to them and thought, I need to make a bold statement. I'm new to this job and I need to do something that's going to assure the community that I have their back and that I'm here listening to them. And so she partnered with a marketing agency to take on the redesign of the iconic rainbow flag. Now this just also happened to coincide with this time of year because it was just the beginning of Pride season and she wanted to debut the new flag for LGBT Pride at the city's annual flag raising event. So with the guidance of artists and designers at this marketing agency and her social impact focus, they took the traditional six-stripe rainbow design and made it 8 stripes once again, adding black and brown stripes as a visual representation of that symbolic commitment of the city's priority to always centering the needs of our black and brown folks who make up the majority of the city's LGBTQ community and who had long felt ignored or worse, discriminated against. So came the creation of the More Color, More Pride flag. And there's an interesting element that I want to point out. So notably, the design is not copyrighted, and that was an intentional choice because Amber felt strongly that it's not the place of any government to tell a community how they're supposed to celebrate Pride or what their Pride looks like or what the official Pride flag is. They wanted this design to be adaptable and usable for communities, not just in Philadelphia, but around the world. And the design certainly did make international shockwaves, as it's become to use increasingly commonly all around the world. Now, when the flag itself debuted, it was picked up by national and international press, and while many people celebrated the flag, there were as many, if not more, detractors from its design, including people from around the world. Gay Times UK wrote at the time that certain parts of the community rejected the flag, claiming that black activists had hijacked a symbol of pride. Some went so far as to even extend threats to Amber and members of the office. And being the hero that she is, they took it in stride and continued to make waves around the world with this design and the subsequent policy work that followed. So after the unveiling of the flag, the Office of LGBT Affairs, in partnership with the Philadelphia Commission on Human Relations, compiled the results of their findings from those hearings and created a detailed report with actionable steps to address the community's concerns, including mandatory implicit bias trainings for bar and nightclub managers, increased monitoring of their actions that followed, and swift enforcement if they failed to comply. The city's anti-discrimination enforcement agency was firm in their commitment to making lasting change, stating in the report that it provided a rare opportunity to address racism head-on, and that the neighborhood had an opportunity to model a neighborhood that has made intentional change and could serve as an example for other communities. I knew back then, before I even began my studies at Penn, that I wanted to work with Amber Hikes and in the Office of LGBT Affairs, because as a former artist and designer, to see firsthand how the transformative ability of something as simple as a visual symbol, like a flag, can speak to the power of social impact and positive change. And I knew that if I could be in the room with a great mind like that, then my possibilities were limitless. So when it came time to interview for field placement opportunities, I approached the director of my program at Penn and I said, I understand you want us to work at a nonprofit. This is the government. It's not exactly the same thing, but it's still social impact work, and this is really important to me. And he understood and suggested that I make the connection. I was thrilled. Now I just had to convince the mayor's office that they would let me. So I reached out via a cold email to my predecessor, the then deputy director of the office, who was tasked with staffing student interns, and I said, hi, I'm an interested graduate student. I've seen your office's incredible work with the new Pride flag, and it would be my honor to work with you. Weeks passed, no response. Not taking no for an answer, I sent a second email, and maybe an overzealous voicemail, or like 5 or 6. And much to my surprise, eventually I received an offer letter signed by the mayor himself asking me to show up on this day and get started. I was shocked and amazed that my campaign to join the office had worked, Some may call it bullying, I'd like to call it forceful advocacy, but either way, I resent it. So once I began working in City Hall, it was definitely a steep learning curve for me. For somebody who had only casually volunteered or worked at a few nonprofits in the past, to diving headfirst into the deep end, managing one of our country's largest cities.
At this time, I was the only white person working in the mayor's office of LGBT affairs, and to my knowledge, the only white male person who had ever worked in that office. So I felt a great deal of anxiety and confusion around my selection to participate in the office, and certainly a pressure to perform at a level of excellence to effectively earn my keep and my position there. But at the same time, I found myself withholding my feelings and my insights, no matter how valuable I thought they were. And I recall on more than a few occasions being asked to speak up or participate in meetings more because I didn't want to take up space as the lone white voice in the room or the lone male in the room, or often both. It was important to me that I was making space and providing opportunity for others, not taking it up for myself. But my hesitance began to fade on my second day in the office when Amber click-clacked down the hall in her stilettos and signature colorful power suit. I can see it now. And she scans the office full of anxious-looking interns, points at me and goes, "You, you're coming with me upstairs right now." Now, I didn't know what was happening, but I was just thrilled to be included, so I had no idea what I was walking into or signing up for, and had I known, I probably would have backed out. And at this point, I didn't even think Amber knew my name. I had only been there a couple of days, and here I was getting dragged upstairs and through the imposing wrought iron gates of the mayor's executive office on the second floor. And as we're walking upstairs, I became particularly conscious of my attire, dressed on the more casual side of what we call business casual. I was wearing a polo shirt, not a suit, nothing like this. And after my first day on the job doing arts and crafts, I knew better, so I thought. Thinking this day was no different, I was dressed casually, and lo and behold, Amber and I, round the corner, walk into a wood-paneled cabinet room with a 50-foot-long table in it, the mayor seated at one end, the police commissioner at the other, and dozens of uniformed police officers down either side. And when I tell you, I almost fainted. I almost did. And commanding the room as she was wont to do, Amber introduced herself as the executive director of LGBT affairs, and much to my surprise, knowing my name, introduced me as her policy fellow, which I appreciated not being called an intern. And sitting down, turned to me quietly and asked me to take notes during our meeting. Hearing their impassioned advocacy on the subject of the day, which was developing a policy with the Philadelphia Police Department to guide their interactions with transgender residents, had me awestruck. The mayor, the police commissioner, and dozens of the other men in the room sat rapt at attention throughout this hours-long meeting. And afterwards, Amber pulled me aside and said, "Do you know I asked you to come with me to this meeting?" I said, "No, I really don't. What was that about?" She answered, "Because I needed somebody who looked like you to sit beside me in that room full of mostly white men and help them to pay attention." I had never felt that way about my identity before, and it stayed with me in my professional development ever since. At that point, I began to realize that my identity could be a useful tool in this work, and that I had the right to be here and was just as valuable in this position as anybody else. So after that moment, the academic year progressed on, and before I knew it, I was preparing for graduation. And I did not have another job or position opportunity lined up, and as timing would have it, Amber pulled me aside one of the days as we're approaching graduation and said, "Hey, I want to talk to you about something. Have you ever considered working in this office full time?" I replied, probably too enthusiastically, "Yes, of course, I would love to, but I didn't realize there was a position for me. Both the positions are filled." "Yes, the mayor's office for a city with 1.5 million residents only has 2 full-time staff dedicated to LGBT affairs." And that's when they told me they were planning to resign as the executive director of the office, and that the then deputy director was likely going to replace her. And that meant that the deputy position was going to be open, and that she wanted me to serve as that next deputy. I was floored at the opportunity. In fact, I believe the first words out of my mouth at the time were, "Shut up, really." But despite my protestation, she calmed me down, as she had so many times before, and reminded me of my own superpower. Amber said, "Look, I know you, I know your ethics, I know your politics and your priorities, and I know that we share these things together. I know that you're committed to prioritizing Black and brown folks in our community, trans folks in our community, disabled disabled folks in our community, people who need vocal advocacy in City Hall. And I know that we share these priorities, but there's a lot of rooms that you're going to be in where people will be much more open to hearing those priorities coming out of your white gay guy mouth than they'll hear it coming from my black queer self. I realized that the deliverer of the message can sometimes be just as valuable and as important as the message itself. Prior to that moment, I had seldom given it much consideration, but after that interaction, I really held it with me and took it to heart because I realized how much value there is in the power of your identity as an individual. So time progressed, I graduated with a Master of Science degree, Amber left their role for a new one with the ACLU, and spoiler alert, the deputy director did not go on to get the executive director position, and eventually a new executive director named Selena Morrison was selected to leave the office the following year. That year being 2020, specifically the spring of 2020, and specifically the second week of March of 2020. I don't know if any folks remember what happened at that time, but it was a pretty consequential period in, I would say, human history. So begins my boss, new Selena. I'm still working in the office, still as an entry-level kind of coordinator position, and all of a sudden the entire world shuts down and we begin unexpectedly working from home with my poor new boss not even days into the job. And I thought for sure I'm going to get the axe because I figured there was no way that lowly little me was going to make the cut as dozens of heads were rolling across the mayor's office. But as luck, opportunity, fate, whatever you want to call it, would have it, I was spared because there was no one else left to train the new executive director who worked in LGBT affairs and knew the ropes already. So I stayed. And I've been with the office ever since, eventually going on to become its deputy director the following year. And Selena and I have made a great team in that time. But when she accepted her role back in 2020, she actually made history by being the first openly trans person, and certainly trans person of color, to lead a city office here in the city of Philadelphia. And it was a history-making accomplishment, to be sure, but just like me, she had not worked in the government. She also came from a nonprofit background. And it was a really steep learning curve, not only for us to be both stepping into new positions, but also navigating this once-in-a-century global pandemic just days into a new job. So we reached for the proverbial masking tape and pushpins and figured it out as we went. And one of the first things that we realized in those early days of the pandemic, and certainly became more apparent over time, was that the disparities that already existed in our society that affected the LGBTQ community adversely, or the disabled community, or communities of color, were greatly exacerbated and did, to our worst fears, grow worse over the course of the pandemic. As we saw, there were folks who already struggled with access to food, now having no way to get to the grocery store safely and get their meals, or folks who struggled with access to medical service with no way to visit a doctor without compromising their health or delicate medical situations even further, and the list goes on and on. So we leapt into action at the opportunity to provide support for some of our city's vulnerable communities. And one of the ways we provided support was to create a database that centralized all of the resources that were emerging, specifically affirming to our LGBTQ community. Now, Selena said at the time, there are some members in our community who are not going to patronize a business or attend an event or receive healthcare from a provider without seeing the rainbow symbol somewhere in their office because they need to know that they'll feel prioritized and safe when they're there. And I think that's an accurate assessment. Our community was in crisis. They needed to know that their providers had their backs. So what we were able to draw on after a few weeks of working from home, virtually meeting every single day with local social service organizations, of course, were in panic mode themselves, was begin to figure out how we can meet the needs of our community in this time of unprecedented change. So I began to compile a list of all the available resources for our communities across the city of Philadelphia, because the last thing that folks needed, in my view, as they're trying to struggle to access their health care in the middle of a pandemic, was to be misgendered, met with insensitive or lack of affirming care, or treated with discrimination while they're in the middle of a pandemic and a health crisis. So we worked quickly to develop what became known as Coping During COVID, a resource guide for our LGBTQ communities in the city of Philadelphia. I pitched the story to a local newspaper, and overnight, hundreds of residents began to use the database as an essential tool to keep themselves afloat during the pandemic. And to this day, it remains one of my proudest accomplishments in the role to date. And I look back at that time, and I realize that, like everyone, we were truly just making it up as we went, masking tape and push pins. The resource guide was, it was nothing technologically groundbreaking, it was just a publicly accessible Google Doc that was continuously updated as certain resources became available or had expired. And the guide itself was regularly updated with these services until as recently as a few months ago, when we eventually pivoted from being a COVID resource guide to a more evergreen resource of community supports that now exists on our page on phila.gov. And it still regularly used by our community members. But at that time, in the early days of the pandemic, it was a lifeline for our communities, and one that got serious traction, not only here in local news, but became a model that we were able to share with our community partners and sibling offices across the country.